Welcome to Zero Downtime, the new podcast brought to you by DCD's editorial team in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical infrastructure provider.
Vertiv has kept the world's leading businesses connected for more than 50 years. We build, deliver, and support critical infrastructure that's available, sustainable, and future-ready. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Welcome to DCD Downtime. And today I'm really excited. I'm going to be talking to Brian Cantrill of Oxide. And if you've not heard of Oxide, well, he can tell us what they're doing and he will tell you better than I can. Over to you, Brian. What on earth is Oxide up to?
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Peter. So we're a computer company. We a bit iconoclastic and very deliberately put that right on the tin. We are the Oxide Computer Company. So we are making a computer. We're making a computer. And one may well ask, well, wait a minute, are you making like a PC or what are you making there? And our big belief is that one, cloud computing is the future of all computing, which elastic computing, that is to say. But we also believe that that model should not be available in a rental only model. Right now, if you want elastic infrastructure, true elastic infrastructure, you've got to deploy on a big public cloud, on AWS, on GCP, on Azure, what have you. And we believe that there are people who want to own that. And there are lots of reasons why you might want to own that. You may want to own that because you have certain regulatory compliance, you've got particular the risk management that you need to conduct it. Maybe you've got certain latency requirements. And then a big one that I think we're seeing increasingly is just the economics of it. As it turns out, like it's actually economically a good idea to own something if you're going to use it for a long period of time. If you're going to use it for a week or two, rent away. If you're going to use it for a year or two, you probably want to own. If you know you're going to use it for longer than that, you definitely want to own. So we felt those are kind of the big theses of the company. And then from an engineering perspective, our big belief is that the way to deliver those kind of systems is by really co-design the hardware with the software. We're not doing any of our own silicon, but we've done our own board designs, we've done our own switch, and more importantly, really, we've done all of the system software from the lowest levels of software. The real reason, when we say hardware software co-design, the biggest motivator for that, honestly, is the ability to control that lowest level of software in the system. The software that we call firmware. But firmware is really just software that you can't see or manage very easily. And that anyone who knows who's run a machine in a data center for any protracted length of time, you know, their eye will start twitching when you start talking about the BMC or IPMI or Redfish or dealing with a BIOS upgrade or SMM. I mean, all of these things, these kind of firmware constructs get the eyes twitching because they've been a source of real difficulty for deploying actual systems. And we felt that in our previous lives. My co-founder and I, Steve Tuck and I, worked together at Joyent, a cloud computing company. Joyent was acquired by Samsung and they really exploded the scale of Joyent. And we really saw how much the traditional on-prem model, which is to say buying Dell, HPE, Supermicro, rack and stack servers, and trying to run that at scale, you can have arbitrarily sophisticated software. And frankly, we prided ourselves on the sophistication of the software, but there's a real limit to what you can go do. And if you look at the way the hyperscalers have done it, that's not the way they've done it. They've actually designed their own machines, and those machines look very different. So that is the long answer to what we're up to at Oxide. Big build. This is one of those where it was asked recently. It's like, well, you know, did you take? I know you raised venture capital. I mean, is that the route you really had to take? And I would say that for a company like this, this is what venture capital is built for, because it takes a lot of, you got to go do a big upfront build. It took us 3 years to build this thing. So, you know, a lot of hardware and software together. We've got terrific investors, launched late last year. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun to get that actually into customer data centers and get some experience with it there. And we're humming along here. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, you mentioned fun, because actually one of the things I noticed talking to you and your colleagues earlier, you do seem to be enjoying what you're doing. And I mean, one of the things that, I mean, you say you're selling a computer. This, I mean, it's not what I would think of as a computer before. It's a rack. You know, you're not sliding in an HP server or a Dell server and finding a cable and connecting it to a Cisco switch somewhere. It's the whole thing in one unit, and that's just bizarre, but also kind of it makes you think, why has it not happened like that before? Because you know,
And not for lack of trying. So if you, I would say that technologists all know that racks, at least the rack scale is the right scale which to design. I mean, I would say at least, because I think Google would rightfully argue that, like, actually you need to be designing at the data center level, not just the rack level. But you cannot achieve these real kind of hyperscale architectures by architecting at the 1U or 2U level. You really do need to think at the rack level. I think that technologists have known this. I think we've seen a couple of trends that have made this even more vivid and visceral. Things like power management, you really need to do power management at the rack level. I mean, how many data centers have got, you know, start off racking and stacking 1Us or 2Us only to be able to go, you know, a third or half the way up the rack and not be able to fully populate the rack because they're drawing too much power and they've got no ability to kind of finally manage that or understand the power draw of those systems. So
All those servers have got little tiny rectifiers in them. And
I gotta say, like, you know, the kind of the deeper we get into this, the more I appreciate about, because this is one of the first design decisions we made is, when you look at systems at hyperscale, they have a DC bus bar. They've got a rectifying shelf, a DC bus bar. So the rectifying shelf takes power whips and it's going to convert from AC to DC. You're going to run DC up and down that rack. That is the way Google runs. That's the way Microsoft runs. That is the way Meta runs. That is the way AWS runs. They run machines that have a DC bus bar. You really can't buy a DC bus bar based system from Dell HPE Supermicro, which is kind of shocking.
And especially when it's like it's 10 years or more or since we've had OCP, which was theoretically going to democratize that and give OCP open compute racks to everyone.
That's right. And you know, I love the OCP effort. And there's a lot to be said for it. Amir Michael, who is one of the technologists who spearheaded OCP when at Facebook long before it was Meta, we spoke to him actually on our podcast. We're big fans of podcasts like you. When we started the company, it was really interesting to get his perspective on why he started OCP. And a big part of it was, you know, hand on heart, he wanted to democratize it. I mean, I think it's easy to be cynical about kind of these big tech efforts, but, you know, when you get to the technologist inside the big company that was really spearheading it, it was exactly what you described, Peter. It was, I want to democratize it. I see how different what Facebook is deploying in 2010 now, as you say, like more than a decade ago. Right? This is, you know, it's 15 years ago. I'm looking at the difference between what Facebook is deploying and what is available commercially. And I don't think that gap should exist. I think other people should be, and we want to democratize it. And that was the genesis of OCP. There are a lot of challenges when you go to do that. I think that the biggest challenge, I mean, honestly, with OCP, again, we love OCP, love the OCP effort. I think it's very important. It is kind of happening at a bunch of different levels. The biggest challenge and the reason that, like, we at Oxide can't tell, we have an OCP rack that we're making, is like, well, there isn't exactly such a thing. There is an OCP rack specification, but it's really just the mechanicals of the rack. The big challenge with OCP is that they didn't really incorporate the software component. So there wasn't, you really, in order to really succeed at the kind of an OCP effort, you really also need to pull in open firmware. That started the change in the last couple of years. But the existing players have been pretty recalcitrant with respect to the adoption of open firmware, which is extremely important in order to be able to make a successful open compute project. But yes, there's this huge gulf between what is available commercially and what actually people are running at hyperscale. And this one is like, I mean, we knew we were going to do a DC bus bar based system because that was like pretty obvious. And so, when you know you're going to do something, you don't necessarily take apart the 10,000 reasons to do it, because like, I already know I'm doing it. So these reasons are not actionable. But boy, as time goes on, there's just like more and more reasons that, and I'll give you a recent one that kind of came to the fore for me. So we have got these, in part because we were developing both hardware and software together, we actually need to develop the software before we have the hardware, which is its own real engineering. This is a kind of an evergreen engineering challenge when you're co-designing hardware and software, is that you will have the hardware long after you need to start developing the software. And how do you develop the software on the hardware that isn't the real hardware? And part of the way we were doing that, of course, is we had our own commodity machines. We had our own one use in our lab at Oxide. I feel especially... my heart really felt for one of my colleagues, Josh Kluo, who was responsible for managing these monsters, it felt like every problem that we had over the years was manifesting it in these little machines we had to manage. And I'm like, Josh, we need to start a computer company. He's like, yeah, I know, I'm at that computer company right now. I'm trying to solve this, so I don't have to deal with DMC problems. And I do my problems. But those machines are really interesting, in part because they are a visceral reminder of the world that we were in for so long. And one of the things that I noticed, because I one of the many things to notice about these machines is they are unbelievably loud. Well, they're loud in part because of the form factor. This 1U, 2U form factor gives you these very small fans that have to work really, really hard to move air. And so they're operating at 20,000 RPM, 18,000 RPM, right, in order to be able to move air. If you look at along with the DC bus bar, one of the first decisions we laid down at Oxide was the geometry of the sled. The sled is 100 millimeters high and it's effectively half the width, although not of a 19-inch rack, and that allows us to get 80-millimeter fans in there. So we've got 6 80-millimeter fans. They move air much more efficiently. We were able to operate them at lower RPM, and the whole rack, I mean, the effect is that the rack is like damn near silent. It's you have to like see it to believe it. So we have been kind of viscerally doing this experiment. In fact, I would love to throw out these machines at this point because like they're so like offensive aesthetically. And Steve Tuck, my co-founder, is like, no, like we have to keep these on site to remind people about how bad it is. Like, oh God. I feel I have gestured to these machines like hundreds of times in kind of demonstrating how bad it is. And one of the things that like was striking me more and more is as I'm kind of holding my hand up to these 1Us to demonstrate it, I noticed that the heat is really not coming off of the board and the CPU. There's so much heat coming off that power supply. And that fan, you look at like where the noise is coming from, he's got a bunch of fans there. That power supply has its own fan. And what is the draw of that fan? Most power supplies, I don't know of a single AC power supply that will tell you what the draw is of the fan on the power supply. most of the power supplies don't even speak PM bus. So even if you wanted to have a very enlightened system design, you have actually no way of knowing what's going on inside that AC power supply. But it's actually worse than that. Sorry to go on a bit of a rant here, but this is really important.
That's what podcasts are for.
That's right. That's
really is. Just tell me your problems.
Exactly. That's right. It is, and I love listening to rants of others. So, but those AC power supplies are super complicated, right? A power supply is not simple. which, as a bit of a tangent, we learned, you know, one of the things we've had to tackle in Oxide is various supply chain problems, because we're born during the pandemic, lots of supply chain crunch. And at one moment we had our rectifiers, we use Marauder rectifiers, and really had some scary supply chain problems and everyone had supply chain problems. All those supply chain problems boil down to usually a FET, a field effect transistor, usually a discrete transistor from TI. Felt like those were all the root of all of these supply chain problems. But the so we weren't able to get rectifiers. And we asked ourselves the question that we definitely do at Oxide, you know, a company that has built our own switch, our own compute sled, all of our own software, top to bottom. It's like, well, maybe we should build our own rectifiers. And power engineer Eric Austin is like, okay, I want everyone who thinks we should build our own power rectifier, like, let's get together. We're gonna have a meeting. I'm like, oh boy, we're gonna build a power rectifier. We're gonna build a rectifier. It's like, no. As it turns out, Eric is like, okay, school is in session, and I'm gonna explain to you how exceedingly complicated a rectifier is, and why we will never, ever, ever build a rectifier, and why we are so grateful for the partnership with Murata. We are gonna help Murata solve their supply chain problems. We are not gonna build our own rectifier. And just because rectifiers are really, really complicated. I mean, it's one of these things that I feel this is the story of Oxide over and over again, is the complexity of seemingly simple problems. It's like, you're taking AC, you're rectifying it to DC. We've done that forever. It's like, yeah, we have done it forever, but you need it to be efficient. And you want that. It's very important that that power is, it's got to be clean and level. And there's a bunch of challenges with that, right? Not easy. So back to those AC rectifiers that we have in every single server, because we are rectifying AC-DC in every single server, those have got their own fans. By the way, virtually every data center that I know of has two AC power supplies because, by the way, those fans blow out. When those fans blow out, the power supply will fail. Those fans are even more prone to failure because they're on the hot side of that thing. So there's a lot of heat in that power supply. The other thing that I really didn't appreciate until talking to our mechanical engineers, and Doug Wimmen, who's on our team at Oxide, pointed out that, of course, like, this makes a lot of sense, that your ability to draw air is going to really depend on overcoming the static pressure. And that's going to depend on, just bluntly, I'll put this in software terms, any mechanical engineer I'm sure is throwing up in their mouth right now, but it is harder to pull air through a crowded room. And that power supply is very, very crowded. We have spent all of this effort just cramming components into the smallest area possible, into that 1U or 2U, without regard for what we do in the rack. And the problem is that that's so dense that it is really hard to pull air through. So that fan is cranking on that power supply. And the power supply fan, and again, there are two of them, which leads to efficiency problems and so on. Those fans end up themselves drawing power. So it's like the whole thing is like down the wrong path. And one of the things you appreciate taking a clean sheet of paper is how different that right path looks.
Right. Yes. A whole series of interventions that have to be made because of one decision at the beginning. So you put the bus bar in, you have all the rectifying done in one place at the top. That makes it simpler.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've got our own. So in addition to those rectifiers, as one of my colleagues, Arjen Rutsauer, is like fond of saying it, like we like to make it weird at Oxide. We also did our own power shelf controller for the rectifier. So part of the reason we really like the partnership with Murata is it allowed us to actually build our own power shelf controller. We don't have a traditional BMC, but we do have a service processor that allows us to do basic environmentals and so on. And so we've taken that service processor, put it onto a PowerShell controller that we can then use to really observe how much is being drawn across the rack. So we know everything that rectifier knows, those rectifiers know about how that power is being drawn across the rack.
Okay, yes. And no more 1U servers because science.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I would say the 1U, I mean, it's a bit strong to say 1U was a mistake because it was done at various times for various reasons. So, I mean, it's like, fine, let's, I don't necessarily know that it was a mistake at the time, but given the draw of the parts, given the draw of CPUs, and given the economic need to make those things as dense as possible, that 1U and even 2U form factor does not make sense. There are a couple of big things that don't make sense. 1U does not make sense. I also think this maybe would be a bit more exciting. Dual socket does not make sense. You really want to be single socket. You spend so much extra work on that dual socket, and you really want that. You want to be single socket, multiple sled. You really want to have another unit of compute for that second socket. So we do not have, our sleds are all single socket sleds.
Right. Okay. You're throwing out iconoclasms left and right here.
Oh, I mean,
build your own network. And that's partly because, I mean, starting from first principles, you want to have blind mating. Is that where it starts from or what?
Yeah. So in terms of networking, yeah, that's a great question. In terms of networking, that was a big question we had going in. Knew we would do DC power. Ultimately, I honestly thought that we would do what plenty of the hyperscalers have done, if not all of them, which is to have cabling out the front, network cabling out the front, as I assumed we would do, network cabling in the cold aisle. But as we, so that was my assumption. The big question that we had was around what we wanted to do with the switch, and do we want to, and I was really reticent to have a third party switch for all of the same problems, that all the same reasons that we wanted to take first principles on the compute sled. It felt like a real mistake to throw out all that advantage and have to partner with a Cisco, Arista, whomever on the Juniper, now HPE, Cumulus, now NVIDIA on the switch, in part because we had lived all of those challenges, and it's really hard to build a robust system if you don't control the switch. And so the conclusion that I had come to, albeit somewhat reluctantly, was we need to do the switch. This is when we were raising venture capital, this is the question I was terrified a venture capitalist was going to ask us, namely, like, what are you doing about the switch? No one did, fortunately. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to ask. I'm not going to volunteer.
Because they assumed probably that no one was going to rewrite the switch.
Yeah, probably. Like, no, I also don't have to ask you if you're going to build a rocket for, you know, low Earth orbit, right? I know. So you're right, exactly. Maybe they just assumed we were. But it was actually one of our prospective early angel investors who actually asked the question. And of course, a technologist, and I kind of made it all the way through Sand Hill. He's like, Brian, what are you doing about the switch? I'm like, oh, damn it. I almost got all the way through. I'm like, look, and because I knew, I'm like, look, you're not going to like this answer, but I really feel we need to do the switch. And the thing that was interesting about this particular technologist who was exploring investment in Oxide is that he'd spent a lot of time in hyperscalers, and that actually he was asking that question out of his own pain points, where the hyperscalers had not developed a switch, lived to regret it, and needed to develop a switch. And so his reaction was like, all right, if you're in your own switch, like, I'm in. And I'm like, oh, wow, okay, that's all right.
Because, I mean, they have been, haven't they? I mean, yeah. Some of the stuff that's come out of OCP has been versions of switches that were developed.
You know, and I think for whatever reason, it is... I would call it a secret per se, not something that they've necessarily advertised. I think people are surprised. You're like, oh, like AWS developed their own switches? Like, yes. And they developed their own switches not recently, by the way. This has been true for a long time because they realized they needed to go do this.
Yeah, there was even a moment when I think LinkedIn developed its own switch as part of that Open19 project. That was how the story came to us anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so Open19 is, it's funny that you mentioned Open19, not for 2019, by the way, for 19 is the 19-inch rack.
Yes.
Was an effort, I think Moribund at this point, but it was an effort that was kind of an OCP rival. There are lots of things there were lots of lessons learned from that. We spent a lot of time trying to learn from everybody.
Part of that was just what you were saying earlier about how inaccessible OCP was. Open 19 was supposedly making it more accessible to enterprise customers like LinkedIn.
That's supposedly right. Yeah, that's right. I think that that's part of the problem they're trying to solve. I think the thing that if you talk to anyone Open 19, it's like the thing that everyone gravitated to about what they liked was the networking. There was this Hydra networking connector that people liked. When we did our own switch, so once we made the decision to do our own switch, I still assumed that cabling would be in the cold aisle. And it was only when we really started having conversations with partners around what that connectivity was going to look like. And we were talking to one partner in particular, is like, why are you not blind mating the networking? Like, you control the switch and the sled, like, you should blind mate the networking. And our reaction was like, is that possible? I didn't realize that was possible. And same. Well, in part because like the hyperscalers don't do it that way. It's like, yeah, the hyperscalers don't, the line they had was like, first of all, the hyperscalers all know it should be done that way. And the reason they're not doing that way is because they're afraid to. They're like, ooh, that's like, you know, that's catnip for us. Like, okay. They're like, okay, that's exciting. And I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. Well, we're gonna blind mate networking. And this was actually one, we've been a couple of these, but this was a moment where like, we are going to be betting the company on this. Because if this does not work, we have no product. So like, I mean, this is true for plenty of things at Oxide, but this one felt like a very early fork because all the mechanical is going to be designed around this. Like it's, you can't just kind of whip around cabling to be in the front. So we're going to have a cabled backplane. Their sleds have no cabling in them. They blind mate into not just EC power. They also blind mate into that networking. That also then allows us to solve another problem that we had, which is how do you get the service processor on its own network? How do you network the service processor? Initially, we're like, we actually don't want to do that at all. And we want, your listeners may know of a somewhat obscure standard called NCSI that is a sideband interface that allows for management control over a computer that's otherwise powered off. So you got a computer where like the CPU is not on and you need to be able to manage it. This is the kind of the challenge. But NCSI has got a lot of problems. And, you know, talk about a RAM. I mean, this is where, again, anyone who knows about NCSI has their eye twitching right now. We were very reticent on NCSI. By doing our own switch, by doing our own cabled backplane, by blind mating all of that, we could use some of the spare lanes that we had on the XMAX connector, and we could actually network the service processors together on a separate switch that's on that same switch. So the switch is actually not one switch, it's actually three. It's the high-speed switch, it's a lower-speed management switch on there, and then it's an even earlier primordial network that we use for basic presence that is FPGA-controlled that we call the Ignition. So the ability to control all that allowed us to engineer a much better system that now has no cabling. Because we were betting the company on it, we were really, really careful about a bunch of different aspects of it. Very careful on the mechanicals. Doug Wibben, and again at Oxide, and his team did an unbelievable job on the mechanicals and making sure that, and I don't think I quite realized this until we had Doug on our Oxide and Friends podcast talking about the mechanicals. I must have really had the scar tissue of my own experiences. We're clearly on vivid display with Doug, because Doug's like, yeah, you kept saying that like, you didn't want to have any bent pins. So, that was the concern. The concern is that when you're blind mating in, that you have bent pins, that you don't get a true mate, that you bend the pin. People who've deployed blades back in the day will remember bent pins, or even worse, because we had not a kind of a, you know, some of these early, these not a blade system exactly, but I was at Sun Microsystems for 14 years. If you've got any old school listeners, you may remember the Ultra Enterprise 4000, codenamed Campfire internally. And it had a mid-plane, and compute blades, not, but we weren't blades or compute, the CPU boards plugged into this mid-plane. And bent pins were a real problem when you're plugging into this thing. The worst thing is you have a bent pin on a CPU board. It plugs in. You jam it in. The bent pin not only doesn't mate, but it then bends the pin on the connector. And that bent pin then bends the next CPU, the next good CPU board that you plug in. Now it's a bad, called a bent pin virus. Not good. Bad, 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 bad. So we need to avoid all of that. And really, I mean, I would say not pejoratively, over-engineered it almost, really solved that problem very elegantly. And there is no way to get a running start with it. When you take a compute sled in and you, if you try to jam it in, there's a pin, a physical steel pin that will stop you short of making any kind of contact. And then you actually need, there's a lever that you need to move up and kind of engage with, move that up. And then that lever gives you this very smooth mating. And then Doug and team did a terrific job on, I mean, it's really amazing. Like, how complicated is it to like mate a connector? It's pretty complicated. And there's like a multi-stage process of guide pins and so on, because the connectors ultimately are fragile. It's very important that you have to engineer the system around them to make sure that, that you can do that. All of this really requires, again, just to your kind of the question at the top, you've got to be thinking about the entire rack. You've got to be thinking holistically to do this. You've got to be thinking in terms of both hardware and software and integrating it, or you don't get the opportunity to do some of these things.
Good. And so what you end up with is when somebody comes to you, they buy a rack with a certain number of sleds in and they can add to that as they go.
That's right.
And yeah, I mean, on that previous call we had, Steve walked us into the room and, you know, first sight of this thing, it looks like a piece of stage dressing. It doesn't look like a real computer rack because there's no there's no cables on it. It doesn't make any noise. I mean, that
yeah, that is obviously it's a real delight on that, because if you take someone who's not a domain expert, who's never been inside a data center, they would look at the oxide rack and be like, yeah, I don't know. I assume that that's what they all look like. And then it's like, no. And if you take someone who is, you know, has spent a chunk of their lives cabling and miscabling systems and racking them and wearing ear protection and all of the else, that they're like, oh my God, like, where's the rest of it? Like, you've eliminated so much junk from the system. I mean, you can almost like visualize the pile of garbage of things that we just don't have, like, you know, all of the AC power supplies and all of, I mean, just like we've just been able to really simplify the system to really deliver what you're trying to deliver, which is elastic infrastructure to your customers. I mean, if you're deploying infrastructure internally, you've got customers that are, whether that's one business unit or many, that are consuming the infrastructure that you're providing. And what we've designed the Oxide Rack to do is to better serve those customers and get all of the elements of both the hardware and the system software out of the way. I mean, another on that point, when we started the company, another early advisor to the company is like, you know, you're going to have to be able to run ESX. Like, yeah, we're not going to do that, actually, because we had decided very early on, we're going to do our own hypervisor. We're going to do our own control plane. We're going to do our own hypervisor, because the job of the hypervisor really is to have that machine model, but then to bring the CPU its cup of coffee. It's the CPU that's doing the heavy lift on that. And at the time, that was seemed to be very iconoclastic, that we were just like, well, you know, VMware is very dominant in the market. I don't know how people are going to, you know, how readily they're going to accept a solution that isn't VMware. It's like, well, we felt that maybe, but that we really feel that in order to be able to deliver a true unified product to customers, we had to do the hypervisor. Open source it. Everything we've done is open source. People can see what we've done there, but we felt we had needed our own hypervisor. Needless to say, 4 years later, that same advisor came back. It's like, wow, you guys were really prescient about not implementing ESX, not implementing VMware. And now we've got our own hypervisor that's not VMware. And I think that, you know, the acquisition by Broadcom, you've got a lot of customers that are asking themselves, who are the alternatives to VMware anyway? Because I am really not feeling loved in this acquisition. And we have found that that it gives people the opportunity to think about something a little bigger, perhaps, and not just replacing that VMware footprint, but looking at the Dell and the HP and the Cisco and all that kind of surround. It's like, how can we, let's just simplify that and give you something that you can actually deploy a lot faster and get to your developers a lot faster.
Okay, so I can pretend I've heard of it. What's the open source hypervisor you're using?
That's right. So we're using the bones of it. We're using Beehive. So Beehive.
You're right. I haven't heard of it.
There you go. Exactly. So the history here is really interesting, actually, and it's kind of the history of VMware too. So what VMware really pioneered, VMware showed that that virtualization of x86 hardware was possible. People didn't think it was possible. And what VMware did that was really very creative was treated it as a binary translation problem and treated x86 the way that Java virtual machines were treating Java bytecode. And they were able to get it to perform well enough. And over time, in fact, it was performing so well that it was succeeding in the market so well that Intel and then later AMD incorporated more and more and more of the heavy lifting of virtualization into the CPU itself. And to the point that by the time you hit 2008, 2009, certainly, the CPU does most of the work. Part of the problem was both VMware and its kind of open source equivalent or rival KVM were really developed before that hardware support existed. Beehive was developed after that hardware support existed. So really developed around that hardware support. And so you don't have all these, this Kimu and KVM are really attempting to implement kind of arbitrary instruction set architectures on x86 and so on. We don't want to solve that problem. That's what we're interested in. Beehive is really interested in we're going to virtualize with hardware assist. We did our own, we like Beehive from a kernel perspective. We actually wanted to do our own machine model, which is the machine, the virtual machine, the virtual computer is the thing that you need to go execute when the CPU is you try to access some device, you try to do something, I don't know what you try to do. I need to now execute code that is going to, access this virtual USB or whatever, what have you. Generally not performance critical paths, but they've got to work. It's very important they work robustly. We did our own de novo machine model and hypervisor there that we call Propolis. Propolis is bee glue, so that's where it comes from, Beehive. It's kind of a play off of Beehive. But that's all in Rust, which was and the reason we did that is because a very important feature that we wanted to develop from the outset was the ability to live migrate virtual machines. So we knew from our own experience running a cloud that if you can't live migrate an instance, a whole bunch of lifecycle problems become really gnarly because nobody wants to have their machine powered off. And so you end up with these little islands of compute. That machine is 8 years old, but we can't power it off because we've got a customer on there that can't take the downtime or what have you. And so then that migration becomes more and more arduous. And now that migration is not just difficult. Is difficult because that island of compute is now, getting further and further and further behind. We knew that we needed to have live migration as a first-class operation. That really required us to have our own hypervisor and do our own new machine model, which is what we did in Propolis. Sorry, very long answer to the question.
Okay. And going up, of course, is containers. You've got to do those.
Yeah, so containers.
Or is that just user space?
Yeah, so our belief on that was, which I know that some who have followed me, at Joyen and at Sun, I know I've spent some time decrying the some of the inefficiencies that are inherent in hardware virtualization. But the reality is, and I kind of come to this almost reluctantly over the years, is that, and certainly when we started Oxide, had accepted that the hardware virtual machine is the right abstraction. And that the reason that is the most robust abstraction to build on, when you offer a container service, that abstraction becomes a lot mushier because now it's the OS interface that is the abstraction, not that a hardware interface. And it's just not as well defined is what it boils down to. You can try to mimic it. You can try to emulate it. There's a bunch of things you can do to try to make it robust, but it's a real challenge. So what we wanted to do is give folks a very robust hardware virtualization layer, and then make it easy for people to deploy their own container orchestration. So whether that's Kubernetes, using Terraform to be able to actually provision the VMs, and then using whatever container service they might want. And one of the things we heard from earlier customers is please do not do your own bespoke container service, because I don't want to deal with another one of those. I've got my own, I've already developed my own, and like, I really do not want to be, I'm not using ECS. I'm not using, some of these other container services that are probably fine when you're at a small scale. But, if anyone's looking at their AWS bill and wondering like, how can I improve this AWS bill? It's almost certainly the answer to stop using their container service and to really get yourself down to using those primitives of EC2, EBS, S3, and so on. So we, for that reason, we just wanted to allow people to deploy whatever container service they wanted to on this. But the really important thing for us is that very robust virtual hardware abstraction.
Okay, I've probably got some really stupid questions that you can just laugh at, and it will say, I've solved that already. Some people must kind of look at this and say, but the whole answer is to put it in the cloud in the first place. Why are you doing this so people keep it on premises?
Sure, and I would not necessarily disagree with that. In fact, again, talking to other early investors, the thing I love about Oxide is that you're anti-cloud. I'm like, whoa, not anti-cloud at all. There are a lot of reasons to go use the public cloud. And I think the public cloud has delivered an experience that is extraordinary and, has been transformational. The presence of the public cloud has allowed people to do things that were really hard to do in the pre-cloud era. So I would never talk someone out of using the public cloud. The problem with the public cloud is not the abstractions. The abstractions are great. It's these other problems that you get when you don't have your own infrastructure. It's the economics. And I think we're increasingly seeing, and we knew this would happen, but it's been interesting to kind of watch the momentum build from some unlikely places. David Hanemeyer Hansen, did not have him on my bingo card as somebody who was going to be very outspoken about moving off of the cloud. DHH was born on the cloud. The Ruby on Rails technologist behind Ruby on Rails, Basecamp, a bunch of other things. And very much born on the cloud and an early cloud advocate. One would almost argue a cloud maximalist, I think. I don't think DHH would disagree with that description. And so for him to say, you got to actually take it back on-prem in order to have a viable business. So I think that part of the problem is, Jeff Bezos famously said in 2012 that your margin is my opportunity. And really speaking of competitors, now what has happened is if you're developing a cloud SaaS-based product and you're using AWS as an implementation detail, it's like, well, your margin is actually going to AWS. Like you can take back a lot of that margin by running your own computers. And I think this is going to be especially true as Moore's Law is indisputably slowing down. And as Moore's Law continues to slow, you can expect to get more and more longevity out of hardware. And as you're getting more and more longevity out of hardware, it pays for itself more and more and more. So there are lots of economic reasons to own your own compute. And then there are other reasons too around security, around risk management and so on. Latency are other reasons. And those folks that have those problems, if you have an acute latency problem and I need to be deploying my own infrastructure next to the service provider I go to, or I know that I'm on a secure facility, I'm at a national government on a secure facility, I can't actually use the public cloud. Those technologists are already in excruciating pain because they are trying to deliver modernity in terms of elastic infrastructure, but they're trying to do it on infrastructure that wasn't designed for it. So those are the reasons that there are, and our big belief is that there are plenty of good reasons to not be in the public cloud, but there are plenty of good reasons to be in the public cloud too, especially if you're small. If you're small, if you're new, go to the public cloud. I think it's great. And if you don't have these security concerns and so on, but the day will come when a lot of folks look at their bill and realize that really the only way to get this thing under control is to own the infrastructure.
Right. Well, I think it came a few years back when people started talking about the cloud diaspora, but then suddenly realized just how hard it was. So I guess that's why we need people like you.
That has been the problem. The problem has been, and you've had a lot of folks, you know, Dropbox famously did this and saved a ton of money by building their own hardware. And then you had a lot of folks that were famously coming up to the edge over and over and over again, looking over the edge or even trying to do it and realizing that, like, and you have folks, it's especially hard, you know, you take a, you know, you're at a large, you know, you're at a Pinterest or what have you, and your cloud bill is killing you. It's public. It's obvious how much this thing's costing you. But you also, it's like, you know, how many folks at Pinterest have deployed physical hardware, right? And, you know, what you're contemplating doing if you're Pinterest circa, you know, 2018 or what it might be, you are contemplating building your own oxide effectively. And that is really, really hard. And some of these experiments started, some of them didn't. They didn't necessarily go all that well because it's really pretty brutal. So that's the gap that we have seen in the market for oxide.
Okay. Everyone says that densities are getting so high, we have to use liquid cooling. Where's your liquid cooling?
Yeah, where's the liquid cooling? So we designed the very much did rack scale design to design around the power budget of the rack. We put the power budget at the rack at 15 kW. So we really wanted to hit that 15 kW power budget. And we actually I think broadly speaking, I mean, we hit 15 kW on the numbers. That 15 kW number is a bit problematic because it's both like small by a hyperscale perspective and potentially very large from an enterprise DC perspective. So it's already a bit of a tough spot. So when people say like, well, the densities need to go way, way up, it's like, well, you need DCs that can actually, so you're talking now about going, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 kW per the rack. And like, first of all, you've got some just DC constraints that are really, I mean, that's, you're in specialized DCs. I also do think that like there's liquid cooling. I think we get most interested by hybrid solutions when we look at that, where things like chiller doors, where you're using liquid in kind of one part of the rack, but you're not actually creating a plumbing problem for yourself. I think that it's when you're creating a full plumbing problem in the computer that, I mean, as anyone, you know, it's like, you don't have to have much plumbing in your life to know that the plumbing problems are pretty acute. And there are a lot of challenges with liquid cooling. I think our big belief is like, hey, let's be smarter about the software and let's make sure we've got air cooling going as far as we possibly can before we throw it in and say, we got to go all liquid cooled, because I don't quite buy that we need to go liquid cooled.
Yeah, I keep telling DCD that they need to do spin up a training course for data center plumbers. Need to have some of those.
That's right. That's right. And I think that it's going to be very interesting to see how the GPGPUs unfold, because obviously the draws there are just bonkers in terms of what we're actually seeing, the draw and the heat in the dissipation there. I don't know how that exactly that's going to unfold. I think that it's just economically, it feels to me that like liquid cooling, you know what it kind of reminds me of? It kind of reminds me of supersonic air travel, and where, I mean, you and I are roughly the same vintage, mm-hmm. and, you know, probably remember a day when we thought like, oh, like we'll be traveling, everything will be supersonic. It's like, yeah, well, about that. And there are a bunch of challenges with supersonic air travel, right? There's you've got sonic booms, you've got just the efficiency of it. You've got like, as it turns out, like you really want to be right below the sound barrier. Makes a lot of sense, because the bang for the buck, it's like the difference between going, you know, Mach 1.7 and Mach, you know, 0.8. Yes, it's like a 2x difference. But on the other hand, you're just like, if you make air travel a more comfortable experience, maybe you kind of solve that problem better economically, right? And Concorde failed as an economic experiment. And by the way, the Tupolev Tu-144 also did not succeed. The other what they called Concordsky, the Soviet Concorde. I think that liquid cooling kind of looks like that a little bit, where it's like, okay, yes, if I'm building a dragster, yeah, I want to go supersonic. On the other hand, like, boy, there are a lot of problems that come with it. And how can we get some of the bang of this, be it with the chiller doors and so on, without having to actually have liquid cooling throughout our racks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this morning I was looking at a press release from ZTE, the mobile phone maker. They've done something. They've done their own integrated rack, which has got busbar blind mate networking. They said that's just in the press release. Could be wrong. And they've got a chiller door, and they've also got cold plates, which are the two best plug and play options for liquid cooling. I'm thinking that's a sensible thing.
I think that that's a sensible thing. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's kind of where we'll gravitate. It'd be interesting to check out the ZTE announcement. The be interesting to know the draw of the rack too, because the draw of that rack has got to be, you know, my guess would be 30 plus kW.
I think they mentioned 50. So
50, yeah, there you go. So 50 kW, I'm like, hey, good for them. And they've definitely located that rack close to now you're dealing with like megawatt DCs in order to be able to, as a practical matter. And they definitely exist. That's not necessarily everybody. I don't know that that is the economic problem that makes sense for everybody. I think that I think that economic driver for on-prem computing, how much of that economic driver gets undermined when you are pushing the power density that high? I actually don't know the answer to that question. I think we're still trying to figure that out. My big belief is like, you want the software to better manage power across the rack. Be smarter about the power management in the rack. We are so smart with power management in the laptop and in the phone, right? We do amazing things to extend the battery life of our gadgets. And we've done basically none of that in the DC. And the DC is still, by comparison, is still belching smoke compared to the efficiency of our personal devices. And how can we get the best of all worlds? How can we have a high-performing data center infrastructure but be doing power management in a more intelligent way? And that requires you to be able to, honestly, you have to really design the whole thing together. You've got to design the thing for power observability. So when we designed the rack, power observability is very core to everything we do. Everything we've got in here that can draw has got a PM bus interface such that we can monitor it. We can tell you where everything is going in this rack. And that's really important to understand kind of where some of these inefficiencies are so we can deliver better infrastructure.
So yeah, data center people, you're doing it all wrong. You're building data centers with things that you shouldn't be building them from.
Yeah, I don't know. You're doing the best you can. I think that
they surely are. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one demographic that has needed very little persuasion about what we're doing and why, it is folks who have worked in data centers. And they are, I mean, usually it's like, what the hell took you so long? Like, why did I not have this 20 years ago, 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. Which is its own kind of interesting question. It's like, why has no one offered this? Like, why am I having to deal with this kind of kit car approach from Dell, HP, Supermicro, Cisco, VMware, and so on? And why did it take so long to get to it?
Actually, yes. Why? Well,
And I think that this is where you get to kind of this. It's a big build. It's a big holistic build, and it was in all of these existing players, it was not in their interest to do it. So it is not really in the interests of a Google to do this or of an AWS. Like, why does AWS want to incentivize you to run? And it, like, you know, AWS did Outposts.
AWS, absolutely not. Yes.
Yeah. And they did Outposts. You can tell they're like, you can kind of see them like, telling you should run Outposts while they're kind of nodding no, like, do not do this, because they've economically disincentivized it, and there are a bunch of other problems with Outposts. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense from, you know, the Google perspective. Like, if you have the information monopoly, why would you bother with? I don't care about what people run in their own. I care about what I run in my data centers. Meanwhile, on kind of the other side, you've got, you know, historically VMware that had essentially no real interest in taking on this hardware aspect of the problem, because, I mean, the fundamental problem is where margins were in the ecosystem. VMware, high margin, software only, has got no incentive to lower that margin by taking on this thorny hardware problem. hardware.
HPE, Dell.
And there, and indeed, like unsurprisingly, such as these efforts occurred, they occurred into at Intel Rack Scale Design, at so the Intel RSD. HPE tried to do this a couple of times. Dell tried to do this at least once. The problem there is with all three of those efforts, you actually need to own the software piece of it. And none of those companies, Intel didn't want to own any of the software piece of it. Intel actually was like, maybe we can solve this like just with microprocessors. It's like, no, you definitely can't. Intel Rack Scale Design was a failure because they didn't address software at all. With Dell and HPE, they didn't want to take on the hypervisor and control plane piece of it. And because they were like, no, like that's what VMware does. It's like, well, if that's what VMware does, then you're always going to have this kind of margin standoff. And Dell bought VMware, right? So you'd think like, okay, Dell, you bought VMware. Now is your opportunity to do it. But Dell never integrated VMware. I was on VMware, what was then VMware's lovely Palo Alto campus. Did you ever go to that campus, by the way? That campus is gorgeous. That campus is like too gorgeous. I've always believed that like, man, if you're an infrastructure maker, especially one that like just had a price hike for your customers, you should not have a campus this nice. Or just don't bring a customer here. A customer's going to be like, I'm paying for your lovely gardens here. It's like, Jesus. There's a real danger of being a little too nice. But that campus is lovely. But one of the things that I observed when I was down there, it's like, it's VMware everywhere. I was down there when VMware is very much part of Dell. Talking to, it was then the chief product officer of the time at VMware, now the former CEO of VMware, and talking with him about what we were going to do at Oxide is before we'd started the company. And the problem that we saw with respect to hardware-software integration, and he's like, oh man, tell me about it. We have so many problems with Dell, I can't even tell you. Like, you have problems? Aren't I at Dell right now? This is Dell. Like, I'm sitting in a Dell. Aren't I sitting in a Dell campus? But it's like the way he spoke and thought of Dell was not of, and I'm like, aren't you the same company? And he said, you know, you'd think that, but no. And of course, like when you have these different business units, like they, even those business units, they might as well be separate companies. And they don't, what you really needed was, and there was kind of an opportunity to do this that they didn't really take, of like, what we need to do is actually blow this up. And actually a combined Dell VMware really could have done this. They would have had, but it is also, this is where you get to the absolute classic innovator's dilemma. It's very much real. Like the innovator's dilemma, the idea that like, we are going to develop a better product, but it is one that's going to disrupt our existing lines of business. It's going to be problematic for our existing lines of business. And it's like, well, you're not going to make friends internally doing that. And you are going to spend all of your time fighting off other BUs. And in fact, when we were starting Oxide, the challenge with Oxide, I mean, a lot of technical challenges, but it's not like no one knew about this problem. There were these structural reasons why no company was incentivized to do it. So I would like freely talk with everyone about what we were doing with Oxide because I'm like not really worried about, like, it's not like a state secret that this is what needs to be done. And I was talking to an exec from HPE at the time, we're talking about Oxide. He was agreeing that there, again, like the VMware conversation before we started the company, he agreed that there was a need to do it. And he asked me, he's like, are you really committed to doing this? And I'm like, well, we just described how important it is. So like, yes, of course I'm committed to doing it. He said, no, that's not what I mean. I mean, are you committed to doing it as a startup? And I'm like, now I'm not following. Like, what are you suggesting? He's like, well, could I convince you to come to HPE and do it at HPE? And I'm like, no. First of all, if I were to come to HPE and do this, so we announced this new effort, I'm going to spearhead this effort at HPE. Finally, the rival business units inside of HPE have something that brings them together, something that they can all agree on, namely that my business unit should die. I will spend all of my time dealing with their conflicting MBOs, fighting it like internal struggle. And you know, I guess I described this pretty vividly. He's like, wow, okay, how do you, have you worked for HPE? I mean, I think you're right, but how do you know that? It's like, because I've been in a large organization, because I did this at Sun where we developed a new storage appliance, even though Sun had no share, spent an inordinate amount of time fighting off folks internally that wanted to sabotage our effort. And it's like, that's no fun, but that is that's the reality that these companies had. So there was this big standoff. Software companies didn't want to take on the whole system. The hardware companies didn't have the guts to actually do the software. No one wanted to disrupt their existing lines of business. And time passed. This needed new company formation, which is why we started Oxide.
Oh, brilliant story. Brilliant. I mean, the fact that it's obvious this has been needed and it's been impossible to deliver it, is the story's there in all the different buzzwords we've had promising it, you know, rack scale architecture, hyper-converged infrastructure, software-defined data center.
Private cloud, right? Before that,
yeah.
Private cloud. Like, I can't even say private cloud, even though it's like, people are like, isn't this a private cloud? Like, it is, but like, it's private cloud is such a Superfund site it's like a buzzword Superfund site. So I can't actually mention private cloud, but yes, it's basically private cloud. Yeah, absolutely. No, we have all, and that's because people know the problem that's in front of them, which is I need to deliver Elastic infrastructure. I need to do it on my own owned infrastructure for one of these reasons. And I am suffering, not able to do it. And then people just kind of walked away from it and pretended the market didn't exist. And I think that for folks that were enduring this problem, it was really, really frustrating. There's nothing more frustrating than being told that you don't exist. Especially when you're like, I'm a customer. I want to buy a product. Like, I very much exist. I'm not asking for a handout. I'm asking for an offering that I can go purchase. And I think people felt pretty frustrated and disenfranchised over it, which has been one of the things that's been exciting about Oxide. We knew this when we started the company. We knew that the internet was going to be rooting for this company. And I think that one of the things that's been most satisfying is to see like the various flavors that has taken. And it's been really great. So we've got a bunch of folks. And of course, now the downside of that is people are like, when are you going to do your home lab edition? It's like, well, not soon. <There's gonna> be, sorry, home labbers. I love you, but no Oxide home lab forthcoming. That enthusiasm that, and you know, we see it in the energy behind, you know, our own podcast and the folks that are just really excited to be taken on the journey and to learn about what we're doing and the problems that we're solving. That's been really, really fun. Cause I love to get into like the details of this stuff. I mean, obviously, right. But the details are really, really interesting. And it's been lots of fun to talk about that and to have a really enthusiastic reception for that, because people want to see this company exist. And that's a real privilege.
Brilliant. Well, that's an hour and that's a long podcast for us, but you're just, in terms of your podcast level, you're just getting started, but I think we probably better call it a day for now.
Well, that sounds great.
It's been super great talking to you and I really have enjoyed everything you said. So thanks for talking to me. Yeah, Brian.
Peter, thank you so much. And, you know, thank you for serving this underserved demographic. I would encourage, though, in addition to your podcast, check us out on the Oxide and Friends podcast. Add that one to your playlist too.
Absolutely, I can endorse that one definitely.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm a fellow podcast lover, so I definitely love it. Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Brilliant, lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Sustainability is no longer a nice to have, it's a priority. Vertiv Power, cooling and IT management solutions for critical infrastructure, are designed to reduce the use of energy, water, and space. From innovative liquid cooling to dynamic grid services, we work hand in hand with customers to enable them to meet their data center sustainability goals. Visit us at vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Thanks for listening to the Zero Downtime podcast, brought to you in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical digital infrastructure provider. Don't forget to like this podcast and subscribe to our channel. We'll see you again next time.